everybody, welcome again to F This Movie, the podcast that makes life fun. My name is Patrick Bromley. I am joined tonight for a discussion of David Fincher's 1997 movie, The Game, by the winner of every game, Alex Lawson.
The object of this podcast is to figure out the object of the game.
You can find our website at fthismovie.blogspot.com. You can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fthismovie. Like us on Facebook at facebook.com/fthismovie. Email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com with show feedback or suggestions. You can find us in the iTunes store by searching F This Movie. And as always, if you like our show, if you're a fan, if you want to see it continue to grow, go ahead and leave us feedback in the iTunes store. You scroll down to the bottom and you can leave us a star rating. You can leave us comments if you like. And you can listen to us through DVD Verdict. If you go to DVDverdictPresents.com or go to DVDverdict.com, home of tens of thousands of DVD and Blu-ray reviews, and click the podcast tab at the top of the page. Thank you to everybody at DVD Verdict for hosting our show on Thursdays. We drop our shows on Wednesdays at fthismovie.blogspot.com, so it's like you're getting it a little bit early. Hopefully, many of you are participating or at least following along with our 30 Stars of Summer game challenge. I don't know what you want to call it, but every day.
I mean, we're more than halfway through the month. I feel like we should have arrived at some sort of definitive.
Right? Because you're right. It's not anything. It's a weird like test of your character. Because
you could call it a participatory exercise, but that sounds really stupid.
It doesn't. It does not roll off the tongue. Every day in June, we're watching a movie starring a different actor. Go to fthismovie.blogspot.com to see the calendar. You can still jump in for the last week and a half, 2 weeks of the game participatory exercise.
Boom.
But yeah, thank you to those of you who've been playing along. Alex, I know you've seen a couple movies for the first time, or are these all movies that you've seen before?
And now I haven't participated every day. There are some diehards, and we commend all of them for participating every day in the participatory exercise of 30 Stars of Summer. That's going to catch on, man. I'm telling you.
You think so?
Starting now, the groundswell here, 18 days into the month, it's going to go. I have not participated every day, but when I have, yeah, they've all been new.
Oh,
and
okay.
It's really, I mean, not that, like, you need an excuse to watch new movies, but I really think it's really cool to have this sort of impetus to do it.
Yeah.
Through our site, and people seem to enjoy it, and I hope that they will continue to do so.
Yeah, me too. The challenge I'm facing is I want to watch a new movie every day because, like you said, it's a good impetus to watch some things that I've never seen. So that's been cool. What I'm discovering, though, is that if I were to instead watch movies that I really want to watch, it might be a lot more fun because I'm seeing a lot of stuff that's not very good. And part of that is because I'm sort of subject to what is available on Netflix Instant for a particular actor, but also because there's a lot of actors where, like, I've seen everything that actor has made that I really want to see.
And you constructed the calendar, so, like, you picked people that you had a proclivity towards.
I mean, no, not necessarily, honestly.
No?
I was just trying to come up with a mix of, like, some older, some newer, some respected, some less respected. It really, not to say I didn't put any thought into it, but I tried to not overthink it, if that makes sense. It was, like, sort of... As people flew into my head, I would put them down or like.
Because it feels really well thought out.
No, it's really not.
The other day when I, because I didn't really look ahead, or I did it, like I gave it a cursory glance, but I didn't commit any of it to memory.
Yeah.
So every time I see like our Twitter feed or on Facebook or however I seem to discover it, I was really pleasantly surprised that Keith David was involved.
Yeah, yeah.
And I watched They Live for the first time. And, you know, like I said, I mean, I was just really pleasantly, it's been hyped up a lot because
right.
I know how much you love it and people, you know, who do this podcast love it. And, you know, it's just, this is, if nothing else, this is a good exercise to just see to get around to seeing things that I never did get around to seeing. And so I've seen a lot of good things.
Right.
Because I'm going out of my way to watch things that I know I've heard are good.
Right.
Starring these people.
Right.
That I just maybe for whatever reason never really got around to seeing. So
that would be a much better way to do it than the way I'm doing it. Besides They Live, have you seen anything good lately?
Well, yes. If I could, this is, I'm sort of double dipping here in terms of what we've seen, but I wanted to continue a dialogue that we started on yesterday's 30 Stars of Summer post, which is Gary Oldman. Okay. You responded to a comment I made. I didn't respond back because I didn't notice that you had responded until today, and it sort of runs contrary to the nature of the participatory exercise that I would then continue, like, after people probably won't check back to that day when we're done.
Sure.
But I watched Rod Lurie. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, good. That's what was the name in my head. All right. I watched Rod Lurie's 2000 movie, The Contender, with Joan Allen, Gary Oldman, who was the subject of our post, and Jeff Bridges, among others. And I found it to be a really mixed bag, specifically the performance of Joan Allen.
Okay.
And you really, you seem to strike a different tone with you. I was surprised at how absent she seemed in, like, most of the scenes. It's very strange.
Okay.
And on a separate issue, I sort of respect what the movie goes after. I understand that she does not want to dignify the, you know, question, the very charged questions that are being directed at her. She's, you know, a nominee for the vice presidency, and it comes to light that she had this very sort of lurid past. I won't delve into it too much further, but she doesn't take questions. She will not even address the questions, because, you know, the thesis of the movie is sort of that if she addresses them, that means it was okay for them to be asked.
Right.
And that's perfectly noble, and I think that that's interesting to explore.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that the movie sort of undercuts itself when, I was sort of purposely oblique there because I didn't want to spoil anything, but I do kind of have to spoil The Contender.
Yeah, go ahead.
It is kind of, she has that conversation with Jeff Bridges, and she then says that none of that stuff is even actually true.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's very odd. I can understand why she wouldn't want to say that in the context of a congressional hearing or things like that. Like, I understand that the point of not wanting to address it. But it does seem very weird that her natural reaction, even in private conversations that are not being recorded, would not immediately be to deny. I mean, I guess, like, the character is almost nobler than my mind can compute, and maybe and that doesn't mean that it's bad or that it's unrealistic. It just really sort of didn't wash well for me.
I mean, I understand what you're saying. I think it's an interesting reveal, only in that then what the movie has been about is not the question of did she or didn't she, which again is not the question that should be asked. The movie is about the discourse. And
yes.
And had she immediately said that's not true, then it's either a question of having to prove that that's not true, or like she says, you are making it okay for that to be asked because you just have to deny it. But what she's trying to say is these questions need to come out, need to leave the conversation. And obviously, the movie is a response to sort of the Ken Starr hearings,
yeah,
of Bill Clinton in the late 90s. I mean, I have to wonder if part of that too is like a screenwriter cop out. Maybe it's not. I mean, maybe it is what I'm saying. But in a way, it could be a screenwriter cop out because what it then does for the audience is that it makes them way more comfortable with the Joan Allen character because now we know that she doesn't have that in her past, and so she's okay. But again, yeah, that flies in the face of everything else the movie has said, which, yeah, is, you know, you can have a healthy sex life. Again, you know, it's nothing particularly lurid. It's just this question of did she or did she not, like, have some sex? You can have a healthy sex life and, you know, be a viable candidate for office.
Yeah.
And, but right, the movie kind of backpedals on that a little bit and says, like, oh, but I didn't do that stuff, so we can all go to sleep tonight. I don't know. And honestly, I have not seen the movie since probably 2000 when it came out. I remember, yeah, liking the Joan Allen performance. I tend to like Joan Allen.
I really do too.
But you could absolutely be right. Yeah. I don't know. I was more interested in the Gary Oldman. We had talked a little bit in the comments because you had said you kind of liked Gary Oldman. And I just, sometimes I like, you know, the way, like in True Romance, I love Gary Oldman's weird white pimp Drexel Sure. Because you might not even know that that was Gary Oldman unless you knew going into it. But then it set this tone with him where, like, he becomes this weird Lon Chaney figure where he has to disappear under all this weird makeup and hair and funny voices, like, in everything he does. And I felt like he could easily play that character in The Contender, you know, basically as Gary Oldman without having, like, he's balding and he's got this weird white curly hair and these thick glasses. And, like, that's all fine, I guess, but they're not making him up to look like an actual person. So why, you know, why not, I guess, get an actor that looks that way if that's the look you're going for? I found it distracting. I thought it felt like too much preparation from Gary Oldman, you know what I mean? Where he sits down and invents this wacky character, and not that wacky is the wrong word, but like he invents this character.
Well, yeah. I mean, you're hinting at it there. Like I guess he looks strange, but like I was impressed at the fact that he was still, even though I take your point, like he has a very sort of odd appearance, but I really think that the odd appearance that they're going for is just sort of like skeevy looking Republican. But beyond that, I was actually really impressed that he is sort of underplaying every moment. Like I don't think he's like doing any overacting, which he has been prone to do in his career.
I don't think he's overacting. I think he's overcharacterizing, if that makes sense.
I guess.
It's such a stupid complaint. It distracted me. That's all. It distracted me.
Okay. Yeah.
I just play the part, Gary Oldman.
I mean, I was really impressed by it. It's probably a movie I'll revisit. I thought it was interesting enough.
Yeah.
Anyway. Speaking of Gary Oldman disappearing into roles, we've gone a little bit long on this, but I just wanted to – I was reminded – like I was really glad Gary Oldman was on the docket for our – you know, for 30 Stars of Summer because I was reminded of – I think it was like in the late 90s or so, maybe like right after – oh, no, it was right after Hannibal came out. I don't know when that – maybe 99 or when was that?
2001,
2000, whatever, whatever it was, early 2000s, is when Dennis Miller still had his show on HBO, and he had Gary Oldman on to talk about Hannibal, and Dennis Miller sort of, in his, like, Dennis Miller-esque way, sort of summed up all of Gary Oldman's, like, disappearing into the role traits by saying, man, I didn't even know you were fucking British, babe. Like, that's what he said. That's what he said to him right when he walked on the show. Like, he was like, I didn't know this was you in this movie, and then when I met you backstage, I didn't even know you were fucking British, man. Yeah, all of that. That one moment, like, leapt to my mind.
That's pretty funny.
What about yourself?
Well,
outside of our thing.
Yeah, I saw, well, right. I've seen at least 17 new movies that I won't talk about.
Sure.
I saw the new Adam Sandler, Andy Samberg comedy. That's My Boy, which
which everybody should. It's on the site.
You can check it out, on our Facebook site. Go to facebook.com/ifthismovie. You can find the review of That's My Boy. I saw Safety Not Guaranteed. I wrote a review for that at ifthismovie.blogspot.com. I really loved that. But the movie that I figured we would talk about, because you had hinted at wanting to talk about this via text, was that I finally saw Moonrise Kingdom, the new Wes Anderson movie, this past weekend. I really liked it. Part of me is still weirdly resistant to the Wes Anderson style. And I was a very early adopter, and I can go back and watch Royal Tenenbaums, where that the style, I think, really solidified the insanely detailed production design and the very – I mean, the camera work is there in Rushmore and everything. But Royal Tenenbaums, I feel like, was where he – like, this is the Wes Anderson style.
Oh, yeah.
And then he's done that for movie after movie. And it distracted me for the first 20 minutes maybe of Moonrise Kingdom. And eventually that kind of melted away and I was able to just enjoy the story. I thought it was really good. It's certainly, I think, the best thing he's done probably since Royal Tenenbaums. I talked about it last week on the Prometheus show with JB a little bit. He had seen it, and he said it's much more sort of Rushmore and Royal Tenenbaums than some of his recent work. And I thought that was interesting after I saw the movie, because in a lot of ways I feel like it plays almost like Wes Anderson's greatest hits. In that you have Bob Balaban as the narrator, which is sort of a conceit left over from Royal Tenenbaums, and he's dressed up to look a lot like Steve Zissou for some reason.
Yeah, he's got the red hat. Yeah, I thought
and
that was
the big bushy gray beard. You have a lot of shots that are repeated from earlier Wes Anderson movies. But ultimately, at the core of the movie is this love story between these two kids. And I feel like the two kids are Max Fisher and a young Margot Tenenbaum, where it's basically the meeting of Rushmore and Royal Tenenbaums, in that, you know, a character from each of those movies has ended up in Moonrise Kingdom, and it's sort of about them.
I hadn't thought of it to that sort of a micro level, but I think you might be correct. I think maybe I liked it a little bit more than you did, mostly because, but I don't know if my affection for it, and I've thought about this over and over, and I really might have to see it again. I don't know if my affection for it rises out of my sort of disenchantment with the more recent entries in his canon.
Okay.
I can't think, like, and it's so weird when you really think about this, I can't think of another director who, like, when you see one of his new movies, you are, I mean, I guess it's normal for most other directors, but you are immediately sort of evaluating it against other things that that person has done. I don't feel like I do that with many other directors. Like, I didn't see, on, you know, we're talking about The Game tonight, I didn't see The Social Network and immediately think, like, boy, is that better or worse than Fight Club? Like, I didn't think about that.
Sure.
And, of course, it probably has to do with how specific his style is and the way it all sort of has evolved or devolved, depending on your view. But I really liked it, and more specifically, I think it was the first time that in watching any Wes Anderson movie, and this includes Royal Tenenbaums and Rushmore, which are his best in my mind, and I think maybe a lot of people's minds, it was the first time I'd ever been, like, excited in the action that was unfolding. When I think about Wes Anderson, I think about a lot of aesthetics, a lot of cool music, a lot of sort of introspective, emotional stuff. But I was actually very invested in sort of the beats of, you wouldn't call it an action movie, of course,
right,
but
sure.
But I was really sort of wrapped up in the sort of forward nature of the story. Like, are these kids, like, are they just going to get away? Are they going to be caught and still somehow have each other? Will they be pulled apart? It's been a while since I've been, like, that invested in, like, beat for beat of, like, I keep coming back to the word action. It's such a stupid word. But, like, but you know what I mean, right?
Yeah.
It sort of has this very, like, forward propulsion, and it's not all, like, sort of introspective and angsty, like the way Royal Tenenbaums is. And I love Royal Tenenbaums.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it's not like,
well, Darjeeling
what's
Limited,
gonna happen next,
right? Darjeeling Limited for me is the movie that's sort of the most repetitive, where he's just beating the same themes that he's done over and over again.
Yeah.
And it does feel a little bit aimless. And I'm sure some of that is by design, but I know what you're saying, where here there's more, you're more invested in what's going to happen than you are in Darjeeling Limited, because in that movie it's like, hey, either these guys are going to stop being depressed or they're not. And that's essentially what you're waiting for. Whereas this, there's an outcome that you want to see happen.
Yeah. And I can't say that that's been true of, like, a lot of his other movie. I mean,
right.
Fantastic Mr. Fox is like that a little bit, but I mean, I was sort of so, like, wrapped up in the aesthetic of that. And
And because that's based on other source material, or because it's directed at children, you know what the ending of that movie is going to be. The thing that's interesting about Moonrise Kingdom is that you genuinely don't know
how
things are going to resolve. Yeah. You really don't know what direction it's going to go. And the movie even, I think, has some fun with that, where it throws some curveballs, where it really sets up, okay, I really think I know what's coming. And then it either doesn't do that, or it does that, and then just shrugs it off, and I won't say than that. JB's wife, who is very brilliant, made this observation about the movie. She said, it's not just about kids. It seems to understand what childhood is like, what it feels like. And that stuck with me as I was watching it, because she's absolutely right. Like, so many movies about kids are made from the perspective of an adult who's just sort of remembering things that happened as a kid. But it's very much filtered through an adult's nostalgia. And Moonrise Kingdom, to its credit, feels like it's told from the perspective of these kids. And there are adult characters, and I don't think they get the short shrift either. I think, especially the Bruce Willis character, the movie does some interesting things with him. But I can't think of too many movies. Where the Wild Things Are, actually, a couple of years ago, I thought did some of this, but I think Moonrise Kingdom does it better, that it really does feel like this is a movie told from the point of view of 12-year-old kids, and that it feels like what it feels like to be that age.
And that's not easy to do. And it's
not at all.
Commended for that, even if you're not like totally on board with all that Moonrise Kingdom has to say.
Yeah,
I think that, you know, it's really to be applauded for the goals that it sets and meets, in my eyes.
Yeah. Did it supplant Jeff Who Lives at Home as your favorite movie of the year so far?
I don't think so. Okay. And I'll have to see. I'll see all of these again, probably, in some capacity.
Yeah.
I still think, I mean, Jeff Who Lives at Home really cut into me into a place that I was not. It's to some extent, it's also about expectations, and maybe like movies shouldn't be evaluated that way. They should just live or exist, you know, as, you know, in and of themselves. But like, I was not expecting to be blown away the way I was by Jeff Who Lives at Home. And I really was. Whereas Moonrise Kingdom, I had sort of like Wes Anderson's really great. Like,
will he
return to form? It has this whole like narrative propelling it.
Right.
I think Jeff Who Lives at Home still is sitting in the catbird seat for me.
I go into a new Wes Anderson movie now, almost the way I go into a new Woody Allen movie, where it's just like, okay, which side is this going to fall on? Is this good Woody Allen or is this bad Woody Allen? And Woody Allen is more prolific, where he cranks a movie out a year.
Sure.
So even if one is disappointing, it's like, well, you know, there's going to be another one in 12 months. Whereas Wes Anderson, it's only every couple of years, but their styles are so specific and the way they sort of repeat certain themes. And so, yeah, I definitely, you know, this is good Wes Anderson. I don't even think he's made a bad movie. Even the movies that I like less of his, I wouldn't say are bad movies. They're only bad, like you said.
Well, see, this is what I'm talking about.
When measured up against his other movies.
His own thing.
Exactly.
And, but
anyway, let's talk about
it.
I'm guessing it's going to be opening wider and wider because it's doing very well in very limited release. It's still managing to like crack the top 10 every week, and it's hardly playing. So I'm sure with that cast and in the interest of sort of summer counter programming, they're going to continue to roll it out. So check it out.
Sure.
Let's talk about The Game from 1997. This came about really just because we were talking about doing a show and I started scrolling through like, well, what's on Netflix Instant just in case you didn't own something. It was something, right. It was something. It had to be something that we both had access to. I didn't know.
And I do own The Game, for the record.
As do I. As do I. And it jumped out at me mostly because Criterion just announced that they're going to be putting it out in September on Blu-ray.
Interesting. Did not know that.
Yeah, there was a long time ago they had a Laserdisc of it, and it's been out of print forever, and it's one of those that like a super collector's item. Like, people really try and seek out the Criterion Laserdisc of The Game because this movie has a huge and devoted fan base. So it kind of jumped out at me like, all right, well, that's been on my mind a little bit because of Criterion's announcement. I threw it out to you and you said, hey, actually,
I believe your exact words were, fuck it, let's do that.
Well, because you had said, I've really been wanting to watch that movie lately. And I know a couple months ago you went on kind of a David Fincher tear.
I did. That was that preceded my Michael Mann tear, which gave us the heat.
Are you on a tear of anyone right now?
I'm not really on a tear of anyone because I've been so like locked into trying to do 30 Stars of Summer. So
I appreciate it.
Mixed up and all that, but when I will keep you notified as to all future terrors.
Okay, good. Thank you. Then we can podcast can spring forth from that.
Sure.
Your thoughts on The Game, sir?
Okay, I'm gonna sort of undercut myself what I just said like 5 minutes ago about not evaluating directors' work against their other work.
Okay,
but not entirely because I don't measure The Game against other David Fincher movies, but watching The Game, something occurred to me about David Fincher movies, and it's that he makes certain kinds of movies. He made more of these lately, that are like about bigger things. And by that, I mean like The Social Network is about like the making of Facebook, but it has a lot to say about, you know, friendship and loyalty and sort of even in a more general sense, like the internet boom, like more macro things to say.
Yes.
Obviously, like, you know, Fight Club is, you know, whatever, you know, post, you know, Gen X masculinity themes is what I'm getting at.
Sure, sure, sure.
There's lots of movies like that that he does. You know, Seven, my goodness, all that stuff. But then there are movies that he makes, like The Game and like Panic Room, and even a movie like Zodiac, that are kind of just about what you're seeing on screen. In the business, they call this like genre pictures, which I didn't want to use it, but that is sort of the term, right?
I will disagree with you about Zodiac, but I'm with you on Panic Room and The Game.
Okay. Well, yeah, maybe it's just Alien 3, I guess, to a certain extent, even though you can talk about like how that's not really his movie or whatever.
But, right.
And that is not to say that any of those movies in his canon are better or worse. Like I said, I don't really do that with him. But I was struck that he does both of those things really well, by and large. It's not like he has to be pigeonholed into, like, I must tell a larger story of how X fits into X. I can just tell you a story that's sort of, like, pulpy and, you know, pretty on the nose as far as what I'm trying to convey.
Yeah.
The Game, I don't mean to suggest that, like, The Game has nothing to say, but I think it has, I don't know, less to say, but that doesn't take away from its, you know, its overall quality. It's a movie I really like. Do you think I'm totally off base at this point?
No, I don't at all.
Panic Room, I guess, are the big ones. Maybe Zodiac I'm wrong on, but, like, those two definitely, right?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. The other thing that struck me when I'm such a weirdo, like I find myself thinking about this more and more. I think about like directors who are no longer making movies either because they're out of the game or they are dead. And I think about like what they, like I think about like, the prolific directors of the past and what they'd be like in today's like media market, how movies get made, and B, technologically speaking, what sorts of movies would, you know, Stanley Kubrick make or, you know, Sidney Lumet make? Although he passed away not that long ago, I suppose. And I've seen The Game a couple of times, and this particular time, for whatever reason, this is a weird way to talk about this movie because you're talking about someone else's work, but I just, this is what sprung forth in me when I watched it. Does this not strike you as the exact kind of movie that Alfred Hitchcock would be making if he was making movies in 1997?
That's definitely the term, the name that jumped out at me. And also kind of with Panic Room, although maybe less so. But definitely with The Game, this sort of feels like an update or a variation on something like North by Northwest.
North by Northwest, yeah. That's at the end in the cafeteria. We won't go into spoilers yet, but like the cafeteria scene where everybody whatever, like that just seems like, so like you can see, I can picture it in the 1960s or something, just like people in their costumes walking around. It just feels like very like behind the curtain type of stuff.
On that level, I would say that the movie is a success as sort of a tribute to Alfred Hitchcock. I've seen The Game probably 3 or 4 times. I saw it when it came out. I give it a chance every couple of years because it's one of these movies that I keep returning to, wondering if I'll see something different. And this, I'm sure, will piss people off because, again, there are people who feel that this is not only David Fincher's most underrated movie, but sort of one of the most underrated movies maybe of the 1990s. It has a huge following. I was
not aware of that, by the way. I'll have to check out some fan sites or whatever they're called.
Yeah. So this will probably make me unpopular. I feel like The Game is a very well-made movie that I just don't care for. I try. It is so – again, it's David Fincher. He knows how to direct a movie, so it looks great.
It does look great. Yeah.
It's well edited. It's, you know, Michael Douglas basically playing every Michael Douglas character. So he's not stretching, but he's very good. You know, it's not that I have necessarily specific complaints about the movie. with the exception of one, which we'll get to later on, and that has to do with the screenplay. Part of it is, you know, so often on this podcast, we talk as though film is this objective thing where it's like, this movie works and this movie doesn't. This movie is good and this movie is bad, and these are the answers. And everybody does that sort of as they talk about movies, yeah, especially in a critical way. But obviously the truth of it is that all of this is completely subjective. It's entirely to the taste and whims of the viewer. And so recognizing that, I know that so much of what doesn't connect with me in the game is entirely personal. And it's for the same reason that I am not crazy about North by Northwest. I don't have complaints about North by Northwest as a movie. I don't like movies where, like, shit keeps going wrong for one guy and he is powerless to do anything about it. This is the goal of the movie. The goal of the movie is to make you feel uncomfortable and paranoid and upset and just oppressed by the badness of it all. Mm-hmm. And so the movie works on that level. But, you know, it's like, you know, some people, they don't listen to depressing music because they don't like to get depressed. Like, I don't like to feel that way. So much of my reaction to the game is, hey, this movie works too well on me. I don't like the way that it makes me feel.
There's a whole legion of people probably who don't watch horror movies for this exact reason.
Absolutely, right.
And you love horror movies.
Absolutely.
You know? So there you go.
So the game works well in, I think, the way that it is intended to work. But that makes me sort of not like it. But I also think, and let me know when it's safe to get into spoilers.
Sure. Well, we could probably just do it. I don't know.
The movie's like almost 15 years old, right?
We're good. I think anybody who's tuning in,
It was interesting because I went to see it when it came out, very interested because I had liked Seven so much.
Yeah.
And I was pleased that it was sort of a change of pace because, you know, I know he did Alien 3, and like you said, it's not really his movie, but it has a certain aesthetic. And I feel like Seven is sort of an extension of that aesthetic, where it just everything's dirty and grimy and gray and awful. And Fight Club sort of returns to that aesthetic in a way. And so I was worried, you know, I was just worried that like the look and feel of Seven was going to define David Fincher, that he was going to that he was going to be that guy, the guy where everybody's hair is a little bit greasy and every sky is raining.
It would certainly be tempting to do so when you make something as good as Seven.
Right. Like, right.
You would, if you're a lesser director, might keep returning to that. Well, but yeah.
So the game is really a different kind of a movie. It's a departure, you know, stylistically it's a departure, like you said, thematically, or even the lack of sort of a theme.
Yeah.
Like you said, it's not really a movie about anything but its own narrative. So I appreciate that he's trying to do something different. And as his career has gone on, you can see that he does that a lot. You know, he's not just making the same movie over and over again. And so I definitely see where this fits into his filmography, where it feels very much like a David Fincher movie. More than ever before watching it this time, I could really see in the way that it's shot and edited how much it looks and feels like a David Fincher movie. And maybe that's just because I've seen so many more of his movies since this came out. He's made a bunch more movies and I've seen them all and gotten to know his style a lot more. So even the way the sort of the colors of the movie and every shot is so carefully and sort of beautifully done.
He really is so good at that. I know we're not reinventing the wheel in film discourse here talking about it, but it really struck me this time too, and I'll get to it too. I mean, I didn't mean to paint it like I'm the one who loves this and you're the one who is not. Like I certainly acknowledge its flaws and we'll get into them, but like, you know, production design and editing and all that stuff, like that is not one of them. And it's just so, it's like immaculate, like the way everything is supposed to look. I mean,
it is. And I'm glad that for the most part, it doesn't overshadow his movies. It doesn't define his movies in that, like, boy, everything looks beautiful, but it's hollow. I think the only time that that's happened is Benjamin Button.
Oh, okay. It happens a little bit in Panic Room with some of the fancy, like that's more an issue of like like all that stuff with the swooping shots over the counter and into the keyhole and stuff. That always played a little showy to me, but that's a minor.
It did to me too, but I feel like that's what Panic Room is about.
It's about the house, you know.
But that it's about being sort of an exercise in style. It's about being this B movie done with A production value and A movie stars. And that's what I've always liked. I like Panic Room better than The Game. And again, I may be stoned for this.
I think I do too, though.
I think Panic Room succeeds at what it intends to be better than The Game does. So we're obviously going to be spoiling The Game from this point on.
I got you off your point there a little bit.
No, that's okay. I'm glad that the look of his films doesn't seem to be his only concern.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because there definitely are directors, even Michael Bay. I mean, his movies look great, but you feel like that's really all he's concerned himself with. And sometimes when a director is so good, has such a strong visual sense, other things tend to fall by the wayside. And I'm glad that for the most part that hasn't happened. Again, I think that is the case with Benjamin Button. So much time is spent on making that movie look so beautiful that I just feel that movie is very hollow. But we're talking about The Game. For three quarters of the game, I'll be on board. I mean, I'm miserable watching it, right? But it's doing its job. It's making me feel paranoid and horrible. And I think the point where it really shits the bed for me is where he wakes up in Mexico.
Okay, that struck me this time.
I don't quite feel like the movie recovers from that point. Having said that, I think it still goes to some interesting places. He comes back. He confronts the guy in the zoo. There's that cool cafeteria scene. Every time I think the movie has completely blown it, it kind of recovers. And I'm like, oh, okay, well, wait. I'll go down this path with
you.
There
are momentary glimmers of hope, yes.
Right. Yeah. Even when he gets up on the roof and Deborah Unger is shouting, you know, like, no, the people behind the door, it's your friends, it's your brother, this is your birthday party. And
she's freaking out about the gun, on the radio, all that stuff,
And you're sitting there saying, like, okay, is she telling the truth? Is this more bullshit? I'm fascinated by the possibility that it's true. And so you're sort of captivated. And then they come through and she was telling the truth. And that's crazy. And then Michael Douglas jumps off the roof of the building. And you're like, well, I didn't expect this movie to go this way. And so if the movie had ended there, I still don't think it's a total success. But I think it's more of a success than it ends up being.
Yeah.
Because I think then the beat that comes after that, where this entire thing has been so carefully orchestrated that they know he was going to jump off the roof of a building or be pushed within this certain like 15-minute time window and land on a target and then attend his birthday party, at which all is very quickly forgiven. I think that I don't think the movie recovers from that.
I would agree. That is the sort of systemic flaw of The Game. Even more, like, I agree with your point, and I'll even go it a step further. There's a scene very early on in The Game, before Michael Douglas's game has sort of begun in earnest anyway. I can't actually remember definitively right now, but he's talking to those two guys, those other wealthy, you know, waspy types like himself, who are speaking very affectionately for the game. Mm-hmm. And like that one guy says, like, oh man, I envy you. I wish I could go back and do it for the first time and all of that stuff. And so it is sort of set up that the game is this really cool thing that really rich people love to play and they are better for it. And they emerge, you know, as different and better people or more enlightened people or something.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have that in your head. So that when things start to get really hairy for him, Michael Douglas,
mm-hmm.
you are obviously thinking like, oh, well, something must be going wrong here. This is not the way it's supposed to go.
Right.
And then when you find out that actually that's all that the game is, like, basically what I'm saying here is that I don't understand any kind of and tell me if I'm like picking nits about things that aren't realistic in a movie where unrealistic things happen, but like I don't understand how anybody could ever want to have this done to them is basically my point. Like, I don't understand how – forget about like – forget about the dangers that are imposed. Like, that all that I'm willing to forgive. Like, whatever. Like, jumping – like, it is a movie, jumping off. But, like, I'm talking about logical – like, how could this – how could a place like this stay in business? I don't understand how people could – I do not understand what is to be gained from participating in the game is basically what I'm saying.
Right, and I don't either. And what the movie
– I don't.
Right. I don't either.
Douglas tries so hard to sell it because he's like – he's got that dopey smile on his face after they take him out of the airbag. And he's right. Just like, oh, you guys really got me. And I'm like, where has this clown been for the last 2 hours?
Well,
like,
that's the thing is that the movie is basically just sort of this variation on A Christmas Carol, where it's like you're put through the ringer. It is. You're put through the ringer.
I never thought of it that way, but yeah, you're right.
He's Ebenezer Scrooge. Yeah. He's this rich, miserable man. He's got everything, and he's but nothing at the same time. He's cut off from the world. He's longing for this past. He is put through hell, you know. And then at the end, it's like, but hey, you're alive. And it's supposed to be this great sort of redemptive feeling and that he's supposed to be a changed man. And I think that's
very
some
strange.
Of that's some of what these guys are speaking to. I'm not saying I buy it, but I think that's where it's going. And let me ask you this, because watching it this time is really where it jumped out at me. Like, oh, this is just A Christmas Carol. And he's Ebenezer Scrooge. But I have to wonder... And let me know. I don't know. Would the movie have been more effective if instead of it being Michael Douglas, this incredibly wealthy banker or whatever he is, who lives in this lonely mansion and has everything but no love in his life, if it had been more of sort of like a normal guy? Because... The conflict that I'm having is, you know, for it to be truly sort of Hitchcockian, what Hitchcock was always great at was that you related to the protagonist. That
yeah,
it felt
the plight of the everyman.
Exactly. Which was why he was always, you know, casting Jimmy Stewart or whoever, because you could instantly identify with him. And so you felt like you were the one going through all this nonsense with him. But by making him by making Michael Douglas's character Nicholas Van Orton Ebenezer Scrooge, basically, I feel like you're about three steps removed, and so instead of identifying with him and going through this sort of with him, you're removed, and there's a weird sort of sadistic pleasure to be had in like watching this rich asshole get his.
That's an interesting thing to mull over. I don't know if that's a goal of the game, the movie that is. I'm speaking, of course, about the film, the game, not the game within the game,
not the game called the game.
Right. I don't think that is a goal of the movie. I mean. Not in that you would take joy in like some sort of like anti-capitalistic sentiment about people who have money and sort of aren't happy. But I do think that like if it was a guy who was sort of like, I don't know, like a, you know, just a middle class sort of like office drone or something, to some extent I feel like the key conceit of the movie is that like the fact that the rich asshole who isn't happy, like, seeks to challenge himself in this way. So I don't think it totally works.
I totally agree. Yeah, because the movie is sort of founded on this idea of these people have everything in order to sort of shock them into appreciating their life or whatever, in order to give them some sort of experience that they couldn't buy. You have to go to this crazy extreme. So if it's just some... guy working in an office, I agree that the movie doesn't work in quite the same way. And I don't know, I'm not suggesting necessarily that the movie is trying to get you to sort of revel in watching, you know, rich asshole twist in the wind, but at the same time, it it goes out of its way to make him sort of such an unsympathetic asshole. And, yeah, you know, like you said, Michael Douglas is really good at selling it. And so the fact that you care about what's going on at all, you know, is really a credit to his performance. But I just feel like because he is such this prick, like, it's just, it's, yeah, it's Ebenezer Scrooge. You know what I mean? It's like, I can't really sympathize with you. I can't even necessarily feel bad for what's happening to him. All I'm left with as an audience member, my concern, yeah, more is what the hell is going on. Not so, yeah, much, will this guy get out of this? Does that make sense?
Yeah, that does make sense. I would also think, or rather, I'd also put forward to you that the movie sort of does get it. If in fact the goal, well, hang on, let me back up. First of all, I don't think, like you're saying, I don't think the movie is that concerned with whether or not you, Patrick, or me, Alex, cares that much about Nicholas Van Norton. I do think the movie sort of exists within the context of the mystery about, is this the way the game is supposed to go, or has, mm-hmm, the game gone totally awry?
Okay.
I think that that is the central question of the game, which gets to my point that I was making before about how it's not really about a lot of things.
Right.
But I will say that the movie, or rather that to bolster that point, I think the movie doesn't really lend itself to having you like him, in that the worst kind of shit starts happening to him like 15 minutes into the movie.
Right.
But are you saying that he came off as such a prick like before the stuff even happens, in that?
I mean, he's a prick from the outset, but no, he's not like beyond redemption. And again, I know that they establish him as a prick so that he can undergo sort of this,
yeah,
redemption by the end of the movie. And we're supposed to feel like he's a changed man, because now in the last 30 seconds, we're supposed to be concerned whether or not he gets a date with, yeah, Deborah Kara Unger. And,
well, that is that. I mean, thank you for mentioning that, because that is a bizarre way to end this movie, by the
right?
way.
I mean, and he just looks very around, and it's like,
like, and then they queue up the White, Jefferson Airplane,
right,
song.
White Rabbit. Yeah, it's very strange. I just feel like the movie hits some really wrong beats at the end. And again, you know, the people that love it probably love the beats that it hits at the end. But honestly, watching it, you know what movie this reminded me of was The Prestige. And the reason for that is not because that they're all that similar, but it's these two filmmakers who are both sort of beloved amongst movie nerds, but also they have their own specific fan bases.
Yeah.
And that each of these movies feels, you know, to the fans of these directors, those are the two movies that are like sort of the bastard stepchildren of their, yeah, catalog, that like, hey,
they are misunderstood.
Yeah, like David Fincher's, yeah, most unappreciated movie is The Game, and fans of Christopher Nolan are sort of championing The Prestige is the movie that is, you know, his most underrated. And I mean, both are sort of about what's real and what's not. If I had to choose, I'm much more a fan of The Prestige than I am of The Game. But that just jumped out at me. I don't know.
It's been a while since I saw The Prestige. I think I only saw it once when it first came out. And, yeah, I'd really like to revisit it now that I've like seen all of Christopher Nolan's movies. I think when I saw The Prestige, I think I had only seen like Batman Begins or something.
Okay.
I hadn't even seen Memento or Insomnia at that point. Like, I was very like green to Christopher Nolan. I'd be interested to revisit it now.
Yeah.
I did want to backtrack, if I could, when we were talking about the ending and, yeah, yeah, the problems that we've both expressed with the ending. I will say that even though it doesn't make a lot of sense from an emotional standpoint, like, I have no idea why Nicholas Van Orton would now be completely okay with everything that's happened to him, and why he would not like have his lawyer on speed dial for what's been going on. Like, I understand like he paid for it, and that is the conceit of why he can't sue them, whatever.
Right.
But even beyond that, I will say that for a movie whose aim is to keep you guessing at a lot of different turns about, like you said, the nature of reality, what's real and what's not.
Yeah.
I am sort of, even though it doesn't all jive together for me, I am sort of impressed with the audacity of a movie that has told you the truth from the very beginning and sticks to that for the entire time. He was literally part of a game the entire time, and that is sort of the twist. the twist, like, I understand, yeah, it's not a novel concept to have, oh, the twist is there is no twist. But for a movie like this, where, like, you know, the most horrendous stuff keeps happening to him, and there are some pretty impressive set pieces in the movie, specifically when he's in the car in the fucking marina. Like, that is, it's really impressive. It's like, how the hell did they shoot this with not a stuntman? Like,
right.
You know, whatever. But, like, I do, for all of the beats that don't work, like, I am sort of impressed. Like I said, I use the word audacity, and that's what I want to keep coming back to. Like, the balls of David Fincher just be like, nope. I mean, I let you in very early on what was happening here. It's just a very intense role-playing game, and that's what it was the entire time. Ostensibly, he was never in danger.
Right.
And while that doesn't work always dramatically, it, in fact, it does not work dramatically at all. For me, I'm sort of impressed with, I keep coming back to just the audacity of it or something. I have to sort of tip my hat to him.
I agree with that. I could be on board for really either movie because the version of the movie where he's set up to do this game and then it turns out like, oh, it's actually this weird, elaborate con where they rip you off and they try to kill you or whatever. Like, I could be on board for that, you know, if it was done right, because for half the movie, that's what it feels like. And by the time he ends up in that cafeteria and everybody's there and you're like, boy, what the hell is this thing? This is such an elaborate operation.
Yeah.
And you don't realize yet that it actually is a game. Like, I could still be on board for that movie, just as I could be on board for the movie that you're talking about, which is what the movie is, where it tells you up front it's a game. And all these hoops that you've been through are just sort of a show to arrive at a conclusion where we say, no, this was all pretend. We told you ahead of time, but you forgot because it seemed so dangerous. I'm on board for that movie. I just feel like maybe my issue with the version of the movie that does exist is that it just stretches my credibility past the breaking point. Like, I'm okay with them pretending to try and kill him and sending his car into a marina and like, boy, this is really dangerous. How did you guys know he wasn't going to die? Because I can say, hey, maybe there were fail safes in place, you know, but the fact that the whole thing is orchestrated to get him to jump off of a building in this weird recreation of his father's suicide, which clearly haunts his every minute and is established from the opening minutes of the movie and even that is sort of, I feel, heavy handed.
Very, very ham fisted. Yeah.
Yeah. And just kind of a shortcut, like, oh, by the way, he has daddy issues. To then sort of use it as this weird, like, we knew you'd jump cause of dad. Ha ha.
I think if I can interject, and I'm not at all saying that the movie earns it, but I think that they are sort of, I think if David Fincher were here, he would. Or who wrote this movie? I don't even know. Is it David Koepp?
No, it is not.
No, he wrote Panic Room, maybe.
It's John Brancato and Michael Ferris.
Okay, well, if those gents were here, I feel like they would say that they arrive at that, you know, ending to his game because of, like, the intense, like, psych evaluation they put him through. I think that's what they would say. I'm not saying that makes any bit of sense. Because that is a pretty long sequence for that, like, just for that part of the, like, the test for his game.
Yeah.
I think that's what they would say. But, to your point, I'm not sure that works or is even necessary. But
yeah, I just feel like when it gets to that point where he jumps off the building and lands on the big airbag with the X on it after thinking he's murdered his brother, it's just about two steps too far for me where it really just pulls me out of the reality of either film, either the film where it's a crazy con or the film where it's been a game all along. And maybe that's not fair, but I just, that beat, I feel like sinks the movie for me. You know, endings are always the hardest thing. And if you can end a movie really well, you leave the movie thinking it's better than it actually was because you walk out on this great feeling. And if you blow the ending, it tends to sort of taint the 2 hours that came before it.
Yeah.
And that's always what the game has felt like to me, that the ending is so sort of ill-conceived that it tends to color my opinion of the previous 2 hours.
There were a couple of things I wanted to talk about that didn't really, that were just sort of like leftover bits that I wanted to address didn't fit into our larger discourse. First of all, I love the use of, for the life of me, I don't know how to pronounce this actor's name, but it is James Rebhorn. Is that how you say it? Was it Rebhorn?
Or? I think it's Rebhorn.
Rebhorn. Okay. Yeah. He is the guy who like administers all his tests and then he accosts him when he finds out he's an actor. I think that that's great because James Rebhorn is like one of the all time great, like, oh, that's that actor from that thing.
Right.
And I sort of really, I'm not saying that David, because this is 97, like, you know, this is, you know, 15 years ago, but like,
You don't necessarily think that him
I'm not saying,
being
yeah, I'm
in
not
the
saying
commercial
like,
is like a meta commentary on his.
Not necessarily, but it certainly plays that way with the benefit of hindsight. And that's something that no matter how many more times I watch this movie, it's always going to make me giggle. It's like, oh, that's James Rebhorn. He's famous for having one of those faces.
Right.
And now he recognizes him on a commercial in a diner or wherever he is.
And again, I really like that scene. And there are all these moments that work so well that I wish that they were part of a movie that I liked more because –
sure.
He's great at creating these sort of what the fuck moments, like where he sees that guy on TV and like, what? That guy's an actor? What the fuck is
great
going on?
Commercial.
Yeah, right.
And the words come up. Oh, it's perfect.
The scene where he sort of accosts him in the zoo and James Rebhorn is like definitely afraid, but still trying to keep an eye on his kids. And like, I like the way that whole thing plays.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
The other thing, which I remembered that James Rebhorn scene, and I look forward to it every time I watch the movie. I had totally forgotten that scene. It's near the end when he's in the car and he is almost a victim of carjacking, is what I'm trying to say. And then he pulls the gun on the guy and gets him to go away. Like that is a joke that is sort of like he sort of bends over backwards to make that joke, but it really kind of lands for me because you are still like when that initially happens, you're like, oh, here's more the game bullshit that he has to deal with. And then he's like, no, this is like, I am dealing with something else. It is beyond what you're trying. First of all, it's weird. The guy's trying to carjack him with like what looks to be a wrench or something. And then, of course, he pulls a gun on him and the man has brought a wrench to a gunfight. And, you know, he's worse off. I enjoy that moment, though, mostly because Michael Douglas in that typical dry Michael Douglas way. He's not what you would call a funny actor, but he has moments in a lot of performances like this one, which comprises a lot of his performances, where he just the sheer dryness of his tone can sort of carry a joke that maybe is a little belabored on the page. But
well, and like you said, it's a good beat that's just different.
Yeah, it's
enough
different. That's,
from everything else because everything else has escalated into this other thing. And like you said, he shuts it down.
Yeah. He gets kind of a win, and it feels kind of good.
Right, because he's finally sort of taking control of things. Maybe part of the problem too with the game for me is I don't think that it's a movie that stands up to repeat viewings. Because after you see it once, you know, you're sort of taken through this what is going on, and then you get your answer, and maybe you like the answer, or maybe you don't. You know. But you have a definitive answer. And then when you see it again, you can appreciate the construction of it, which I was doing this time. But because you know where it's heading, it loses all of its emotional impact because you're no longer wondering, what the hell is going on? You know, you don't get that feeling of paranoia that you get the first time because you know, the answer that like this is all part of the game. He's not in any real danger, and B that it's heading to this ridiculous climax where he jumps off a building because they timed it right. You know,
I'm tempted to say that the reason that it's not as enjoyable the second time is to the point that I was making sort of at the outset of our discussion, and that it has nothing else really to say outside of what it is, and when you know what that is. There's nothing really else for you in it, unless, of course, you really love it. Like, I understand that. But then I sort of hesitate to even make that point myself because I really love rewatching Panic Room, even though I know what's going to happen.
Right. But maybe that's
not. Yeah. And maybe it is just that simple. Like, I don't know. Like is our breakthrough point here? Hey, you like watching movies that you like more than once, and you don't like watching movies that you don't like more than once.
Maybe, but again,
you can only get that here at F This Movie, a high level of discourse.
But maybe that speaks to my theory about Panic Room, which is that what is enjoyable about Panic Room is its construction, is sort of the style and appreciating the shots and the editing. But I also think, you know, I tend to invest way more in the Jodie Foster character than I do in the Michael Douglas character in the game, which isn't to say that the game is a badly constructed movie, whereas Panic Room is a well-constructed movie. But there's this interesting thing, too, where sometimes directors will, you know, keep repeating a theme or whatever. And it's neat when they do the same movie or the same theme, but they do it better. And for me, you know, we had mentioned it earlier, Zodiac is a much better version of the game. If only because it's about bigger things. It's about obsession and paranoia and where that leads you, and this search to get answers that is ultimately fruitless. But I think where the game tries to set up all this paranoia, and it does so effectively, I think Zodiac does it better in the service of a better story, in the service of a better overall theme, or just an overall theme in general, in the service of a better movie. I think the sequence in Zodiac where Jake Gyllenhaal goes to see Charles Fleischer is a better version of what is trying to be done in the game than anything in the game. I think it's more suspect because even rewatching Zodiac, knowing the way that scene turns out never changes how nervous that whole scene makes me.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it just comes down to these things are a little more fun to experience before the alleged payoff, I suppose.
Sure.
It's a little more fun to have happen to you, to be so blunt with my words. Like, no one, I don't think, I mean, like, the game is not a interesting, well, I mean, that's, again, subjective, but, like, it's not, I even think objectively, it is not a pleasurable thing to, like, endure or something, to your point about, like, things always going wrong and things like that. But, I don't know, it's interesting. I'm glad that I talked about how I don't evaluate work against other people, against the canon of the, and all we've done is talk about.
Well, not really. No, I
don't. You know, Panic Room and now Zodiac. No. I mean, but I think it speaks more to, like, you know, his evolution or anything.
Yeah.
Than, like, one better than the other. I think that's pretty well delineated.
Yeah, I don't think we're necessarily trying to place this in, well, where does this measure up within his body of work? I would probably place it, if we're going to do that, I mean,
Well, let's do that.
I mean, I put it kind of somewhere in the middle, you know. I think it's better than a couple of his movies.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the easiest way without, like, a list right in front of us. I mean, I think it's better than Benjamin Button.
Yes.
I think it's better than Alien 3, although not, like, you know, again, to your point of, like, whether you count that as a Fincher or not. I don't know. But I think, unless, if you say a name and I say, oh, yes, of course, I think that's about it, though.
Well,
he hasn't made that many movies.
No.
I did not see, I still haven't seen Girl with a Dragon Tattoo.
See, that's the thing. I'm pretty sure I need to see that movie again.
I haven't seen it.
Right now, I might be willing to say that it's better than Girl with the Dragon Tattoo.
Oh, okay.
But maybe they're kind of neck and neck, and maybe I'll see Girl with the Dragon Tattoo again and like it more. But I mean, yeah, that puts it kind of squarely in the middle, because then you're only talking about Seven and, well, I guess there's a bunch. Seven, Fight Club, Panic Room, Zodiac, Social Network. So that's a bunch.
Okay.
But still, lower, middle, whatever. It doesn't matter. Again, there are plenty of people who will be listening to this tearing their hair out right now, saying, like, I cannot believe you guys don't like this movie more. This is David Fincher's best movie. And that's great. I fully admit that most of my response to the movie is, A, I don't like how upset it makes me, and B, I don't like the ending, you know? And that maybe that's not fair to say, like, that sinks a movie, but for me it kind of does. I will agree that it's a well-made movie. I will agree that it basically accomplishes what it sets out to accomplish. It's just one of these movies that is like, well, I guess that's not really for me.
I have something that will, you know, fittingly go here. I think we're nearing the end of our discussion of the game. This adds nothing really to our discussion, but it feels proper to say this is my, this is one of my mother's all-time favorite movies.
Really?
So she'll be, if she listens, and I'm sure she will, because she'll say, oh my God, they talked about the game. She's going to be pretty disappointed in you. So disappointed she may forbid me from coming on future podcasts, because my mom can still tell me what to do, I guess, in that situation I just set up. Anyway, she loves it, and I think a lot of moms
love it. I'm very sorry, Mrs. Lawson. I'm very sorry.
Well, first of all, she just loves Michael Douglas, like most moms.
Sure.
Like the age of my mom do.
Yeah.
And I think she's really just sort of compelled. I'm not gonna spend any more minutes theorizing why my mother loves this movie so much. This is why I did this at the end. I just want it on the record, literally recorded, that this is one of my mom's favorite movies.
I wish I would have known this ahead of time. Maybe we should have had her on the podcast.
I should have made it clear at the outset. We could have set something up, but I'm sure she'll comment. She'll probably comment.
All right, good.
Be angry about it.
Everybody, anyway, make sure you check the comments for commentary from Alex's mom. All right. Well, thanks very much for talking about the game.
Thank you.
Remember, you can always check us out at fthismovie.blogspot.com and email us future show suggestions or feedback on this podcast or any of our podcasts at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. We will see you guys again next week. Alex, would you like to take us out?
Sure would. I've gotten a great idea for your next birthday present, Patrick Romilly. It involves exploding squibs bursting forth from the chests of your loved ones.
What about clowns?
Clowns with keys. A clown key party. That's what you're going to have.
I'm going to fuck a clown.